All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times and Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City. It is the 29th day of March, 2023. I've titled today's show, Can America Avoid Becoming a Marxist Dictatorship? David Stockman, Michael Oliver, and Dr. Ewan Webster are this week's guests. Wall Street is begging for a return to zero interest rates so it can continue its orgy, essentially its orgy of wealth building, where we see the middle class being hollowed out and the boys from Davos doing extremely well. But as Daniel DeMartino Booth noted last week, if Chairman Powell caves to the kind of pressure the pressure that Wall Street's putting on him, he will unleash hyperinflation. And in her words, you can kiss capitalism goodbye and say goodbye to the dollar's reserve status. Well, is that hyperbolic? I don't know. We'll find out what our guests have to say. Well, it is true that Vladimir Lenin, who served as the first dictator of the Soviet Union from 1922 to 1924, he said, and I quote, "The way to crush the bourgeoisie is to grind them between the millstones of taxation and inflation," end of quote. As the World Economic Forum, of which the Biden administration seems to be very much aligned, seems to have similar goals. Klaus Schwab has infamously stated that the middle class will own nothing and they will be happy. So after more than 2 years in power, the Biden administration is certainly doing a masterful job of following the marching orders of both Schwab and Lenin. So the big question that I want to ask David and Michael as well, I suppose, is will Powell cave? Does he have any choice? That's a big question. Wall Street is betting he will. I mean, I keep looking at the equity markets, seem to have more strength than they deserve. Anyway, really glad to tell you that Michael Oliver is here with us right now. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Always good to have you. So this is a big question. I mean, we know that things are really screwed up, and every credit cycle, they're more screwed up because they never allow the markets to run their course. They never allow the dead wood to get taken out of the economy. They just pump more money into it. We have zombie banks. We have zombie corporations that have been living off of zero interest rate credit. And now when the markets are demanding some kind of a return on their savings, to what extent can Powell control interest rates, and do you think he's going to cave, Michael?
Oh, I think we've been saying this for a long time. He's going to cave. He's got to. The reason is, and I never hear this discussed on the financial TV channels, Fox or CNBC, none of them. The difference this time between 2008 and 9 and now, or 2000, 2002 and now, or 1973, 1974, and now you go on 23 to 20, 29 to 32, is that the bubble that they created with their monetary policy over a dozen year time span, and like you said, you know, theoretically zero rates, okay, for so long, created the biggest paper asset bubble ever in US market history. Mm-hmm. You go back and look where the Dow was in 1923 at a low, and then 29, measure the percent gain from the mid-1990s to the dot-com top in 2000. Go back to the 2002 bear low, measure from there to the 2007 bull market peak, and you've got doubles and triples sometimes. Mm-hmm. Okay. S&P just produced a seven-fold bubble, 2009 low, 2021 high. NASDAQ 100, the leader index, all the big front of Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Google, you know, all the big weighted symbols, 16-fold increase.
Yeah.
The T-bond market, go back and look the last 20, 30 years, you just see this up, 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 upward curve. And of course, it started down well before the stock market did, meaning higher yields, lower price. So paper assets have started to implode. They cannot allow that. They claim they're looking at data points. And they're so stupid. I mean, the data points they're looking at will change. They always change, but they change usually after the fact. In other words, the market speaks first. And by the time you get the data points to explain why the market's in such trouble, the market's in deep trouble. Okay. And at that point, it's too late. The data points are lagged indicators, and they should know that, but whatever. But anyway, it's the biggest boom and therefore likely the biggest bust. Because not only was it big in the quantum leap that it took, but the duration of it. So that you could have been a young college graduate, head of the accounting department at some company, and a CAC, chief financial officer, and you've had a dozen years of never having to worry about the cost of money. It was built into your system, into your planning, into your expectations, your board meetings. So interest rates are low, they're going to stay low. You know, so let's do this. Let's go ahead and commit to build this or hire this. So a lot of decisions were made, not just on a corporate level, but personal family planning and city governments and state governments and federal governments, spending expectations based on a long-held low cost of money.
Right.
Which was falsely priced. So now what are you going to do? Okay. Errors will come to the surface all over the place. And he'll have to fight it by printing more money.
He'll print more money, and then you'll have more inflation. I don't know. I mean, I know that David Stockman's view is that inflation isn't dead. There's no way that Powell's going to get a handle on it doing what he's doing, because he's holding interest rates high, but he's bailing people out. I mean, we're seeing, you know, we just saw these two banks get bailed out. There's David thinks it's just the tip of the iceberg. It's going to be. And in fact, I know that you follow the banking sector and have been sending out some warning signals about banking.
Back in January. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
The banks looked real good. If you looked at after the summer low last year, the S&P made a low, I think it was around 3,700, 3,600, had been as high as nearly 4,900 at the top, but made a low, had a rally into August, then came down and made a slightly lower low in October. Well, if you go back and look what banks did, bank ETFs or the financial sector, once they made their June low, they never took it out.
Mm-hmm.
While the S&P and the NASDAQ went down and took out that low in the month of October, they came back and approached that low, but did not take it out. So they were hanging in much better than was the broad market.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the recent rally up through like January, they looked pretty good. So they were a quote safe place to be.
Yeah.
And a lot of people believe that. Well, we put out two reports in late January saying, watch out for the banks. Nobody's looking at them. They look very vulnerable to us. Like they could ambush you. Well, 2.5 weeks ago, they started to ambush you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they oozed down, then they collapsed. And they've had almost a crash type event. But when you look at what the government is telling us, Yellen and Powell, that this is an isolated situation. It's bad management by this bank or that bank. Not our problem. It's their problem. You know, we can't bail these guys out. So et cetera, et cetera. Well, okay, and especially that it's regionals. It's right. Mainly a regional thing. It's not the big banks. Get out a chart, just a price chart of Bank America, Citicorp, Wells Fargo, go down the list. Bank America made new lows 2 weeks ago, new lows for the entire bear move.
Mm-hmm.
Citibank is very close to making new lows. Not only close to taking out the lows of last year, but the lows of 2020 as mm-hmm. well. Wells Fargo made new lows for the bear move last week. Mm-hmm. So here's three major banks, two of which have made new lows for the bear market, while the S&P has not. Okay. So they've suddenly gone from better performing to vastly underperforming and making new bear lows. And yet nobody's talking about the fact that the two big to fail banks are making new bear lows, some of them.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, why? I suspect there's a they have a lot of bad dead wood in there, especially as interest rates start to rise and as companies, you know, because we it just fosters so much malinvestment, Michael. You know, over so many decades now, and every time we have one of these purges, is it only partially purge anything, and then they bail everybody out again, and away we go. So how does this thing go on forever? How does it break down, and what's going to happen?
I think the world is in upheaval now, not just in the markets, which are just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to have in the street type, quite literally in some cases, response and reactions to what's going on that expose the errors that have been committed, the financial errors over the past dozen, 13 years, et cetera. But just look around the world right now, like go to Holland, you know, nice, peaceful little country. They had extremely violent demonstrations against the government up there, you know, what, 6-9 months ago,
yeah, in which
the farmers even bought a tank.
Yeah.
Okay. No, it wasn't loaded, but it was for the purpose of defending themselves against the green police. Okay.
Sure.
Government was coming down. Well, all of a sudden, the politics of that country have totally flipped. In fact, the farmers, their new political party, won the election and is the dominant party right now. Nobody expected that.
Yeah.
But now look at France. You know, is Paris burning?
Yes. You know,
the book written about World War II in Paris. So it's burning. Okay. And you have some of the most violent street action you've ever seen in Paris going on and on and on. Not just a few days, it's now a couple of weeks and it's getting worse. Then look at Israel. Mm-hmm. Look at the political divide there. It's now being expressed in violence.
Yeah.
Consider the following. This is a variable nobody talks about. America is politically divided. We all know that. Everybody says it on CNN, Fox News, and say, okay, fine. So they think that political division will simply remain as political division, meaning political, just debates. Okay. Trump is definitely going to run for the presidency. Now, he's going to do it one of two ways. He's either going to get the GOP nomination, and he's looking pretty good lately. He really popped up nicely in the last week or so. He's either going to get the nomination, or for some reason he doesn't, and he's not going to retire at that point. He'll run on a third party. He'll create his own independent party. I guarantee it. He's not going to retire. Okay. So he's running for president one way or another. On the other side, you have the Democrat Party, somewhat divided between the old guy and the new left that wants to fully take it over. But forget them for the moment. If the GOP runs with Trump, do you think they can win? Consider the following. About 20% of that party, and this is probably a hard, good number, will simply not vote for him. They're old GOP conservatives, but they are anti-Trumpers, and they will simply not go to the poll.
Right.
No, they won't vote Democrat, but they're not going to vote for Trump. Or if he didn't get the nomination from the GOP and sets up as a third party, he's going to take 20% of the party away from the GOP with him, at least 20%. How can the GOP split in that manner possibly win the national election?
No.
With 20% off one way or 20% off the other, they can't win the national. What happens if it's anticipated well before the election even that, oops, there's no way? What do you think the political consequences will be after the 2024 election among certain key states? Florida. Oops. Texas,
right? No,
parts of Oregon already want to secede from other parts of Oregon. Parts of Colorado have even mentioned it. The secession is on the tip of the tongue of a lot of people.
Yes.
Ted Cruz mentioned it 9 months ago. If the GOP doesn't win the next election, there's going to be a lot of people on that side of the ledger saying, "What are we going to do for the next 4 years?
Right.
Just
right.
sit here?" Or do something else.
Yeah, I think a lot of the southern states could shift with them as well. I don't know about some of the Midwestern states. Ohio, where I come from, I'm not sure.
It's a variable nobody's talking about.
Yeah, I agree. I think as you and I talked before we went on air here, that the Mises Institute has been talking about it. My friend Jeff Deist, and they are definitely talking about it. It is something that's real, I think, but, you know, obviously the powers that be don't want to contemplate that. So,
well, we seceded from the UK, you know,
yeah,
a couple hundred years ago, and a lot of secessions have occurred around the world that actually are beneficial. Some aren't, some are.
Yeah.
But it just means change. And the question is, nobody's discussing that element. They're always talking about economics as if that politics is simply going to continue along. Instead, look at the streets of, you know, Israel, Paris, et cetera. You know,
yeah. Well, no,
don't be shocked.
And not to mention New York City, where I live as well, right. where we have a philosophy of letting violent criminals go out of jail and, you know, and look, try to find some. I guess it was it Stalin that said, bring me the prisoner, bring me the man, I'll find the crime. It seems to me that's partly what they're trying to do with Donald Trump right now. And I have to think, you know, like, can America avoid becoming a Marxist dictatorship? It seems to me that if we move in the direction we're moving now, the World Economic Forum and the Biden administration and others, that's the direction we're headed. I mean, I don't see how you can see it any other way. And then secession, yeah. You could understand people that love freedom, that want to be free and interact with each other and discuss ideas and live freely. It doesn't mix. It's easy to understand why we're divided, Michael, because the philosophy of government is so diametrically opposed to what our founders gave us. And I don't know. If you don't have those values, then I don't know how you can get along. It's pretty hard. Well, let's look at some of the markets then. Basically, I know you put out just recently, you know, the markets you liked, the ones you didn't like. You're still very bullish on precious metals, gold and silver. Mm-hmm. It seems that gold has broken out now, has it? Do you think we're on to something?
I think we've only got one number left. We've had multiple buy triggers since the pullback low last summer and fall. As they turned back up, we issued buy signals as different indicators broke through. Our first major buy on gold was 1700. It was about 75 bucks off of its reaction low. And as far as we're concerned, gold's got all the green lights. Now, there's price charts you can look at and say, well, let's go make a new high. Okay, fine. But yeah. I'm talking from a momentum perspective. Sure. Silver has one level left for it. It's already triggered many of our buy signals. And that's like, I'll tell you how high it is. It starts about 50 cents above today's high. Mm-hmm. And the next final number is about $1.50 above today's high.
Mm-hmm.
That if you ever see like the upper, like 2495 area again, and that's in the middle of the past couple of year range after all. So it doesn't mm-hmm. look important, but to us, it says, that's it, gone. You're going to take off. Mm-hmm. Or silver is going to suddenly come out of this mishmash and get a backbone real quick. So we like the monetary metals. The commodity markets are very interesting because they peaked shortly within about a week after the Ukraine-Russia war began. Okay. So that war didn't cause their boom. The boom in commodities started in October 2020 and extended to February 2022. It basically peaked then. If you look at crude oil or the Bloomberg Commodity Index, most markets peaked in early 2022. Again, about coincident with the war. So the war didn't cause it. The war, in fact, stopped the rally. Okay. Mm-hmm. Since then, you've had a corrective process in almost every commodity. And don't link silver and gold to this. They have a different breathing pattern.
Sure.
They doubled in price while commodities were still at the lows. But anyway, that Bloomberg Commodity Index and crude oil as well, which looks important right now. I don't think it's going to lead the commodity complex in the next up, but I think it'll be a contributor. They both look like it wouldn't take a heck of a lot in percent terms. I'm talking 4 or 5%, for example, of an upturn from where you are now, where they'll re-engage the longer term uptrend that started in late 2020 and has had a correction since, not a bear market, but a corrective decline. We think that next leg could start. Probably it's going to start soon, despite the fact that the Fed has been raising rates.
Mm-hmm.
That the effect of the rate rise is to punch a hole in their bubble. Commodities aren't a bubble.
Right.
The Bloomberg Commodity Index is like 103 right now. Heck, it was well up in the high 200s back in 2008 through 2011. So it's hardly a bubble.
Yeah.
It's only been going up for a year and a half of 2 years also. So it's not a bubble in that regard. So we think that when the Fed finally has to loosen on the rate policy, that the stimulus isn't going into the stock market this time because investor preferences have shifted. It's going to go into commodities again.
Right.
And so I think Stockman's right. There's probably more quote inflation to come if you want to narrowly define it as commodity type inflation. Yeah.
Right. Well, if interest rates are going up, then it doesn't allow a lot of the speculation that took place in the equity markets and, in the tech sector. That, I mean, people could get a free ride and they could try any stupid idea they wanted. There was no repercussions until now. And now Mother Nature is paying a visit, and it's not going to be kind to people that have been irresponsible. Of course, the irresponsibility starts with the Fed and the government that pumps money in the system and tries to buy votes or whatever it does with the money. The equities, so the air that still needs to come out, equities and debt markets, I guess.
No, I think the T-bond market, the long end of the federal debt market, let's say 10 years on out, especially,
yes,
probably saw its low. Meaning it's high in rates. Okay. Long end, I'm talking. We hit a target level back in October that we had predefined as a likely strong bounce point. We didn't think necessarily it'd be the low, but it would be a point in which you'd rally strongly. Sure enough, you did. And now on reassessment, we tend to think that you probably have seen about the worst you're going to see on the downside in the T-bond prices, buys and yields. That if you look at a T-bond market and compare it to the stock market, the T-bond market had a massive corrective, bear market.
Yes.
They took the bond prices back down to about 2009 levels. Be like the S&P trading under 1,000, okay?
Yeah.
Look at TLT, for example, long-term government debt ETF. It wiped out 20 years of upside in the last couple of years. So it paid its dues.
Yeah.
And I think that smart money, scared money, once they realize that the stock market is not bottoming here, but is rolling over again, is going to have to go to the traditional safe place, which is T-bonds, which have not been safe last year, but I think they are now, and gold and silver.
Right, right.
I think
that makes sense. TLT makes sense. I think, you put some money in TLT, if you're right, there's going to be a lot of gains to be made.
They're not going to rival gold, but I think it will be a, quote, safe place to be.
Yeah, a safe place
to be. And big investors and asset managers who... And need to be in bonds as a traditional category. We'll move back into that arena, an area they vacated last year, obviously.
Yeah. Two more things I'd like to ask you. One is GLD, let's say the miners, are they starting to look good?
Yeah. You mean GDX?
GDX, yeah.
The miners have definitely underperformed gold over the last 2 years, as gold has gone mostly sideways with one brief dip. Silver has corrected in a parallel downtrend channel. And the miners have come down a large percent. They don't even look like they're related to gold, but they've moved down with gold while gold went sideways to down. They will snap back more than will gold and will outperform gold probably during much of what's left on the upside. And we think there's a lot left on the upside in terms of price, in terms of gold and silver. And we think the miners at this point are basically at a slingshot low level relative to gold. So they'll snap, catch up to gold on a percentage basis and likely outperform it. And that's their behavior pattern over the decades, by the way.
Is slingshot. Like that.
Slingshots. Yeah.
Whoosh is another Michael Oliver expression, the picture, the beach balls skyrocketing out of the water.
Yeah.
Michael, Apple. What about Apple? I think you saw a chart on Apple. I mean, if there's a blue chip, so-called blue chip these days, it's Apple, right?
Well, we picked three, we call them the big three, Microsoft, Amazon, and Apple. And in January, we went bearish on Amazon, same time we went bearish on the NASDAQ 100, and it had a big drop. Bearish on Apple and Microsoft in February's close of last year, again, 2022, we're talking, way back a couple of months off the highs. At that point, Apple was $166. It dropped down to the low 120s, the worst it did. Far better in terms of less downside than Microsoft and Amazon or the NASDAQ 100. So it, among the big three, it was the outstanding one that said, oh, look at me, I'm hanging in there. What does that mean? It means a lot of investors will gravitate toward that which is not sinking as much as others. So it's perceived like the banks were a couple months ago as a safe place to be. because it's doing better than others. We got up over 160 now in this rally. So Apple's coming back up toward the price level where we said it was a bear, and we still think it's a bear.
Ah.
We're looking at it as shorter term technicals, and we think that if it sneezes, like dropbacks much below 155, for example, this rally's probably over and it's going to rejoin. Now, the reason Apple's important is that if you take the better performing sectors, right now that would have been banks, which is no longer the case, ambush there. Healthcare is one I'd watch. Very well performing sector, just gone sideways for the last 2 years, not down. I think that's very vulnerable to a sharp down.
Yeah.
That will surprise people. And among the big tech stocks, Apple's the one that everybody's bet that, oh, thank goodness, if Apple's behaving well, everything's okay, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you upset them with Apple, like you upset them with the banks, then what does that do to hope?
Yeah.
It's out the window.
Not much left.
Oh, gosh, there's no place to hide.
Not much left, yeah.
That's when you get your sentiment shift. It's when the good ones don't behave good anymore.
Yeah.
I think we're near that point right now.
And that's when Chairman Powell's going to have to pivot, going to have to bail.
Yeah. The next leg down in the stock market will not be the way we described the first one. The first one we said would be arm wrestling. And that's
true. You did say that. And
it will not crash. The second leg will be more vulnerable and more obvious in terms of tone.
Michael, thank you so much for being with us. And I should mention, I don't know that I did when we said hello, it's olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com. Sign up for Michael's letter. It's very reasonably priced. Us middle-class folks can well afford it. So I hope some of you will sign up for Michael's work. It's whenever there's a market that's in trouble or it's doing well or whatever, he sends things out. There's not a well, he does have a regular weekend missive in both for the precious metals as well as the other markets. But during the week, if there's something that's really important, you'll see it in your inbox. He's always there faithfully to alert you to something you need to know. Michael, thank you so much once again for being with us.
Thanks, Jay.
All right, folks, well, don't go away because Dr. Ewan Webster is going to be with me in just a moment to talk about his company's great new gold discovery in Nevada. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Bye, Jay.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And your expertise. Welcome to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. And this is a special segment of my weekly show. This segment was recorded on March 22nd at 6 o'clock New York time. That's 6 p.m. in New York time. In order to enable Dr. Ewan Webster, he's the president and CEO of Thesis Gold, to explain some very positive news that the company put out, will be putting out, will be available for trading before the market opens tomorrow. So we want to make sure that those of you who follow Thesis Gold are aware of this news and get an explanation for it as well. So before I say hello to you, and let me just tell you that the stock trades in Canada under the symbol TAU. You can buy it down here in the States under the symbol THSGF, as I have. There are approximately 65 million shares outstanding, trading at about 72 cents in US money, giving it a market cap around $47 million. And the company is pretty well cashed up with some $15 million or $14 million in working capital. Ewan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Jay. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so your flagship project, you know, I've just learned to know your story a couple of months ago, actually, but the Ranch Project in the Golden Horseshoe area, a very prolific mineral-bearing area in British Columbia. I believe there are three separate deposits, or areas at least, mineralized zones, that you've worked on so far, the Bingo, the Thesis 1 and Thesis 2, a whole lot of other targets as well, but those are the ones I believe that you've done the most work on so far. Can you explain to our viewers the significance of the news that's going out tomorrow morning?
Yeah, thanks for the introduction, Jay. I mean, the Thesis 2, 3 and the Bingo Zone are, you know, they were historically worked on back in the 1970s and 80s, and it was thought that they were kind of smaller isolated zones of mineralization. I think thesis three at the time was maybe about 200 meters in strike length and about 100 meters depth. What we've now demonstrated is that these are not isolated zones of mineralization. They're actually part of a much larger continuous system that we're calling the thesis structural corridor. And that extends over about 1.5 kilometers. Mineralization at thesis three is down to about 400 meters vertical depth. At Bingo and thesis two, about 270 meters vertical depth. And the width of that corridor itself is about 350, 400 meters wide. Within that, there's multiple parallel zones of mineralization as well. So this is evolving into a pretty significant gold system. And you know, as you mentioned, that's just one of the gold zones within the project itself. Maybe what I can do is pull up part of the press release that we're putting out tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So can you see that okay?
Yes, absolutely. Perfect.
Okay, so... I'll zoom into this long section here and you'll get an idea of what I'm talking about. So the red areas are the kind of min domain models that we have, and then drill holes on surface here, gray are historical, red 2021 and green 2022. So you can see the green drilling in fact, all of the drill holes now extending over about 1.5 kilometers, very continuous mineralization through that zone. And we've effectively connected that together. Some highlights from this press release. You can see the headline hole here at thesis two, 8.79 meters of just under 12 grams gold. So
sure.
Great high-grade mineralization right in the thesis two zone. Another really nice hole from that zone as well, 14.5 meters at just under 5.5 grams gold. And then some holes that really started helping tie the whole 1.5 kilometer trend together. Bingo 7 here, which is between the thesis 3 zone and the Bingo zone, just under 35 meters of 1.3 grams gold. Similarly, between thesis 3 and thesis 2, this whole 2022 here, 38.5 meters of 1.6 gold, including 23 meters of 2. So great intercepts, really demonstrating that this is a continuous system. And a lot of upside here to continue connecting this and growing this system at depth together and along strike. And, you know, I've put on this figure, the furthest northwest hole that we have at the Bingo zone, it's 50.3 meters of 1.86 grams gold. And then similarly, at the very south eastern extent of the system, 41.5 meters of 1.15 grams gold. So excellent potential to keep growing this to the northwest and southeast. And I think this is going to be a very significant system as we continue to work on it in 2023.
Right, and I'm looking, I mean, I think I heard you say, what did you say, the width of this of these zones, more or less? We've got the depth here, and we're looking at a 1.5 kilometer strike, but then the other dimension, the width of the zones, more or less, I think I heard you say something. What was that?
So the width of the whole structural corridor, you can see it nicely on this figure here. And these are all 2022 holes that we highlight on this figure, again, kind of demonstrating that continuity. But this is ground magnetics, and you can see this big blue feature that cuts down through here. And it's basically just a big fault zone, and it's about 350 to 400 meters wide. And within that, there are multiple mineralized zones that range from, you know, kind of, I'd say the average maybe on the low end is maybe 15 meters right through to over 100 meters in places.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this looks like and this is on surface or near surface anyway, right?
Basically, all of the mineralization on the ranch project begins at surface. Yeah, so these systems are starting at surface and extend into depth.
So it looks like a bulk mining scenario here from surface, open pit, potentially.
That's exactly, yeah.
And just really getting started, because I know there was I think it was called the Steve target to the south, maybe southeastern portion that caught my eye when I first started following a story, 119 meters grading 1 gram. That's nowhere near this area, right?
No, exactly. I mean, you can maybe see the inset map on this image here. So this is our whole thesis project, sorry, the ranch project. This is the area of the map that we're looking at in the three dots representing the thesis structural corridor. And the Steve target you're referring to is about 3.5 kilometers to the southeast. That was a new discovery we made this year. Fantastic result. That mineralization is down about 450 vertical meters depth. And on surface, large mapped alteration body with high grade gold there as well. So we're pretty confident we can connect that up to surface.
Wow. And it's all as far as, I mean, you show numerous, numerous zones on one of your maps on your website. As far as you know, they're all part of the same system.
I think, you know, they are all probably part of the same system. Yeah. I mean, if I zoom out a little bit here, this at the core of the ranch project, there's probably 40 square kilometers of just pervasive alteration that ranges from kind of advanced argillic and silica alteration. So it's a really just a big, large, structurally controlled epithermal field. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, but the thesis structural corridor, that's situated in that big magnetic low. And if you look at the screen there, just in this area alone, all those abrupt changes from red to blue represent major fault structures. We've only tested a fraction of these, and yet a lot of them share exactly the same characteristics as the known zones of mineralization. So I think the upside to continue making new discoveries is really good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just have to think, Ewan, that when the market starts to wake up to this story, people are going to be sorry if they're not positioned in it now. And one of the things that comes to mind is it's pretty tight share structure as well. And I think you have some major shareholders, institutions, high net worth people, some very well-known ones in here. I just think people should really be paying attention to this story. So anything you might want to add just in summing up, what people should be keeping their eyes on, shareholders and investors, as this year unfolds, you know, your exploration projects, I guess you're going to have some news coming out anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, over the last 2 years, I mean, really we built Thesis Gold around the ranch project. And as I mentioned before that, it hadn't had a lot of work in the last 20 years, let's say. And over the past couple of years, we've been really aggressively trying to drive this project forward. I mean, we drilled over 55,000 meters on the project. We've expanded the known zones of mineralization, as we've just discussed. We've made some new discoveries. We've completed initial metallurgical work with very encouraging results, with gold recoveries up to 98% on all of the different zones. We've extended our land position. We've reactivated a road onto the project from the nearby Benchmark Metals Lawyers project. So we're now completely road accessible. And we've managed to accomplish all of that work while still keeping our share structure very tight. As you mentioned, we've got 65 million shares out. We've got about 14 million in the treasury as we look towards our 2023 drill program. So we're well underway planning that at the moment. I think it's going to be another large, significant program. You know, hopefully I've demonstrated that we've got a lot of work to do here to follow up on these fantastic results. You know, a large focus of this year's program is going to be at that thesis structural corridor, as well as continuing to expand the mineralization we have at Bonanza Ridge, following up on that new discovery at the Steve Zone that you mentioned, whilst making sure that we're still testing a range of these new targets that look the same as those known zones of mineralization. So it will be another very exciting year as we try and move this project forward quickly.
And how soon can you start working there?
It will be probably late June by the time we get going. But we're fortunate in this part of British Columbia that it is not the rugged terrain of the coastal mountains. It is rolling hills. We get a fraction of the snowpack. So it's definitely manageable to work year round in this part of BC.
Wonderful. All right. Well, this is really exciting, Ewan. And I want to thank you so much for spending the time with us. Really a great story and one I'm going to want to keep up with, that's for sure. All the best to you, and we'll look to talk to you sometime in the future.
Great. Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm pleased to have David Stockman with me once again. David is, most of you know, is a prolific writer. He shares his insights as a former Wall Street insider and Washington insider. He writes a daily missive. It's the Contra Corner. And I would strongly suggest that you consider subscribing to David's letter. It's David Stockman's Corner. .com, I believe, is a place to go. Anyway, if you just Google David Stockman's Corner, you'll get it. Very reasonably priced service. Those of us who consider ourselves middle-class folks have no problem at all paying for David's daily missive. And there's just a wealth of information there. So, David, thank you so much for joining me again.
Happy to be with you. Lots to talk about now, especially the last couple of weeks.
Oh, my goodness. It's just, I don't know. It's nerve-wracking. It's not peaceful. It's a lot of, who knows, but we're really glad to have you here because I think maybe you can help us ferret things out. You were, you know, David, you were the first person that I remember just sort of adamantly saying, Powell is not going to pivot anytime soon, if at all. He's not going to pivot because inflation was heading towards double digits, maybe still is, but at least it seems to have calmed down a bit. And you said he's not going to pivot because they're scared as hell of the inflation, and they're seeing people coming at them, the Fed's seeing people coming at them with pitchforks and torches, yeah. Is the word you used. So, you know, and then you said that, and I said, wow, this is something. This is a new view of things. Then Daniel DeMartino Booth kind of echoed your views since that time. And she actually, I think it was just last week, she said something to the effect that if Powell caves, if he doesn't hang tough, we could be heading for hyperinflation and an end of capitalism as we know it, and forget the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Do you think Danielle may be a little hyperbolic on this?
I don't know. Right? She's pretty insightful, pretty sharp on most things. And, you know, was an insider at the Fed at the highest level, the Dallas Fed, for a long time.
Yes.
So maybe I don't know what comes after capitalism, but I know that capitalism, as it can be defined in any common sense way, is long gone, especially now after we've had yet another bailout.
I mean,
here they go again, and this time it was so unjustified, so unnecessary, that it tells you how far gone the system is. After all, the Silicon Valley Bank had assets, sounds like a big number, 200 and some billion, but that is 0.6%, 0.6% of the 30 trillion of banking assets in the U.S. economy. So if a few 10 billions of their deposits were going to go flee to some safer pastures environment, so be it. That's what capitalism is about. Markets are in the business of constantly reshuffling activity and assets and liabilities as everybody strives for a better result on their own account. And when we freeze things and stop this process of reallocation, we're basically gutting the central impulse that makes for capitalist growth and prosperity.
Right.
So, you know, now that they have essentially said, without any legal authority, you know, they bailed out all of the assets or all of the deposits in the system. There's 18 trillion of deposits. 9 trillion of them were uninsured because for 40 years Congress had a chance to raise the deposit limit sky high. It didn't, and for good reason.
Yeah.
There was no consensus to do it. And now all of a sudden, you get a bunch of cowboys running the Silicon Valley Bank who were making egregious balance sheet mismatches between hot deposits. They had $150 billion of uninsured deposits, and taking on long-duration assets that were already sinking in value substantially last year. Did they do anything to get prepared? Did they do anything to build in a buffer, a cushion? No. You know, they were caught like deer in the headlights because they were so incompetent. And then the Fed and the Treasury and the FDIC come along and basically reward incompetence, reward, you know, reckless risk-taking. Yeah. Now, when you do that so many times, as we've had, as we've done now since, you know, really the late 80s, after a while, the system gets fundamentally changed. You've got basically socialism on the downside and capitalism on the upside.
Right.
And that isn't going to work. That's not stable. It's a self, you know, defeating, self destroying proposition.
Right. And in the end, even those people who are getting super rich, at least on paper, do they not see how this could result in just absolute carnage, absolute poverty? Do they not understand where socialism leads? We've had the experience. We've had several examples, even in my, you know, even more recently since the fall of the Soviet Union. They don't see it. They don't care. They don't give a damn. They just want to get rich, and they figure they can have their own hideout somewhere. And what? I mean, I don't get it.
Yeah, well, maybe that's part of it, but it also is that when you go, it's what I would call the recency bias. We create all of these rationalizations, all of these justifications for anti-free market actions or policies, and they accumulate one on top of the other. Then the players in the system get so used to, you know, Uncle Sam being the great savior, that when an event like the SVB and Signature Bank bailout occurs, no one's shocked, no one's surprised, because, well, and it's easy to rationalize. They're saying, oh, you know, deposits are sacred in some way. So these depositors didn't make the decision to, you know, load the balance sheet there. They took the balance sheet from 18 billion of long duration, you know, government bonds and agency debt to 100 billion in 1 year, okay? And more than 90% of that 100 billion had a duration of 10 years or longer, okay? So, but there, you know, the argument was, well, we didn't do that. I mean, among the depositors, the management of the bank did. Well, that's, yeah, but you're a big boy. It's your money. It's millions of dollars in these business accounts and, you know, venture capital accounts and startup company accounts. And it's their job to look after it. It's not the job of the government. And once we say that the government has to look after everybody's money, well, then they're going to take control of everybody's money. It's one, it's a simple step from, you know, being the safety net to being the controlling agency in the entire economic system. And that's unfortunately really what we're heading for right now.
Right. It seems to me if government takes control of everything, of your money, then it seems to me that's kind of like Marxist dictatorship. I don't know. I mean, it's just, I'm just saying. But David, it just doesn't, it's just, I know that Americans have fallen behind, way behind all the advanced countries in terms of math and science and all that. But good Lord, you don't have to be a genius to figure out that the math just doesn't work. It doesn't work. I mean, if you look at, I mean, anybody that looks at David's charts will see the exponential rise in debt relative to GDP and all kinds of other statistics that he provides almost daily. You know, and then you start to look at what a $30 trillion debt, what happens with an increase of just 1% in interest rates, or then we go to 4 or 5% or wherever we're headed. Well, let me ask you then, David, you said SVB and Signature Bank is just really the start. It's just the tip of the iceberg. Some people, like at Bloomberg, I heard somebody saying this morning, well, you know, these are sort of unusual situations. You don't usually have a situation where you have all these rich people that are uninsured depositors of the bank and all that. But and Signature Bank too, I think you pointed out there was some really irresponsible behavior on their part as well, the management's part. But why is this just the tip of the iceberg then? Is it, these aren't just anomalies? Is it because the whole interest rate structure, it has to rise along with inflation, it has to go up because it just has to? I mean, those are the laws of economics, right?
Yeah, well, it's the tip of the iceberg. And I think you look at it two parts. First, did a lot of rot develop in the system over the last decade or two decades? Answer, yes. SVB was only an illustration. It wasn't an aberration. It wasn't an outlier. And why? Well, because the Fed kept the money market rate, which drives deposit yields, deposit rates, at 1% or under for over a decade. And so what happened was that the banking system was flooded with ultra cheap deposits. And, you know, they were like kids in the candy store. All this money's coming in. We don't have to make big credit risks. All we have to do is make a duration, a little duration spread, buy the longer term and capture, collect the spread between. And then, you know, laugh all the way to what I call the stock options bank, because their stock prices went up tremendously because earnings, and these really weren't sustainable real earnings. It was just the earnings that come automatically out of a unbalanced, unsustainable balance sheet. And anyway, so that happened throughout the 5,000 banks in the United States, not just the one big bank of the moment, or two in Silicon Valley and the Signature Bank or Republic Bank or a few others that the Bubble Vision has on the screen every day. I think it's widespread throughout the system where discipline broke down because there was just too much money that needed to be put to work. And then beyond that, you had all the distortions caused by the Dodd-Frank Act, because the Dodd-Frank was going to solve the instability problem, so-called, by these stringent capital standards. But they had many tiers of standards. Only the big banks were really under the tough standards. But everybody was under a capital standard that said government debt is risk-free. So when you're calculating your capital ratio to assets or your equity ratio to assets, you don't have to count the government debt. Well, bank managers and executives took them at their word. So they loaded up on agency and government debt because it had no capital requirement. That meant that they didn't have to put their earnings back into the balance sheet to support asset growth. They could pay their earnings out in huge, fulsome dividends and stock buybacks because they didn't need the capital to keep growing because they kept buying things that Dodd-Frank said don't need any capital. So, I mean, this was like a manufactured disaster in Washington. That's the first part. Now, the second part is that as the Fed tries belatedly, and I would say way belatedly, to catch up with this inflation monster that's been on court, they're dealing with a totally different economy. Some people want to make fun of Powell saying, you know, he thinks he's a latter day Paul Volcker. So I took that point, you know, as a challenge the other day. And I said, what's the difference between the structure of the economy that Paul Volcker, you know, wrestled to ground and the inflation that he brought to heel and what we have today? Well, very simple. If you look at the total debt on the economy, business, household, government, and financial, and look at the ratio to income or GDP, it was 1.6 times in 1980 when Volcker had to take on the big inflation battle, and is 3.6 times today. Now, that may sound like, what does that mean? Well, two turns of debt. As anybody who analyzes businesses and balance sheets know, against income, two turns of debt against income can be a really big factor. So if we look at our GDP today, which is about $26 trillion, the answer is this. If we still had the semi-prudent leverage ratio that existed in Volcker's time, debt to GDP. Mm-hmm. There would be $42 trillion of debt on the U.S. economy today. There is actually $94 trillion. Okay, so in round terms, the American economy that Jay Powell is attempting to cool down and the inflation that he's attempting to bring to heel is in the context of an economy that's carrying around $50 trillion of extra debt. So what happens when you raise interest rates? Well, if you had the Volcker ratio, a 1% increase in interest rates would raise debt service costs by $400 billion a year, rounded. Mm-hmm. At today's level of $94 trillion of debt, 1% gain in interest rates across the board, which is what they're trying to do, will raise the service costs, the carry costs, by $900 billion a year. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've got a balance sheet that's lugging $50 trillion more of debt, and if you've got cash flows that are being cut by a half a trillion per annum because of the changed leverage ratio, it's not the same economy. This economy is far, far more fragile than it was in 1980.
Right.
And so therefore, as Powell, for the reasons that we can talk about, attempts to rein in the inflation and throw the brakes, monetary brakes on, is going to cause far more broken furniture, far more crises like the SVB and all the other small banking issue that we've had in the last 2 weeks. This is just a taste of things to come, because there are what we call malinvestments, distortions, imbalances embedded everywhere in the economy when you gave people an incentive to swing for the fences and expect that interest rates would never rise.
Right. Well, certainly the Austrian economist understood this, predicted this, Ron Paul and many others, not enough members of Congress that understand economics well enough to know what they're doing. But I have to think, David, that there are some very smart people around the world that do get it. They do understand that the U.S. is in big trouble. The Western world's in big trouble. And I have to think that countries like China and Russia and others that are saying, we don't want your dollars anymore. We're going to set up our own system. You tell us we can't even use your SWIFT system. We can't even use your dollars. You're taking the dollars away from us. We're going to set up our own system. And so they have. The Shanghai Exchange, I think, for both the futures exchange for oil as well as gold. It's my understanding that Saudi Arabia is now selling oil to China for yuan. And if they want to, they can shift it into gold. It seems to me the BRICS and these countries are saying, we think maybe the dollar's time is nearing an end. And I don't know, do you think, I mean, it 2008 or so, it seems to be when China and China really opened things up for gold ownership and really started acquiring huge amounts of gold. They don't talk about it publicly, but Alistair McLeod, who's on this show, frequently does a lot of work in that regard. And they have built up their gold reserves dramatically, and Russia has as well. China's the largest gold producer in the world. So I don't know if you have any thoughts that geopolitically you made the point. I think you said. It was about the time I had you on this show when Biden was talking about sanctions with Russia again, going into Ukraine. And you said, this is crazy as hell. This is going to do more damage to us than it, or it's going to do as much damage to us and the West than it does to Russia. Well, I think you've been proven right about that. But do you think there's some, that these other countries are starting to say, wait a minute, we're not going to play ball with the United States anymore?
Well, this is a really important discussion. I used to be somewhat more sanguine about the dollar, and my basic argument, which I think was valid, was, they're doing a lot of bad stuff in Washington, Fed's printing way too much money, but still the dollar is the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry.
Right.
But what has happened now is these characters in Washington have burned down the laundry.
Yeah.
That's effectively what they did when they basically told the world that Russia had $600 billion worth of deposits in the Western central banks, mm-hmm. and they froze them all.
Right.
Okay, and then they put sanctions on all kinds of activity. And then they're trying to talk about secondary sanctions on people who don't observe the sanctions.
Yeah.
And they basically have gutted the dollar-based global financial system and settlement system. And where that leads is exactly what you're talking about, and that is new non-dollar-based forms of payment and clearing, and that obviously will undermine the value of the dollar. Mm-hmm. And as the dollar weakens, not necessarily overnight, but relatively speaking, over a period of time, it'll make it even more expensive for us to finance this $30 trillion of government debt that we have, $31 trillion, and the $94 trillion of total debt on the U.S. economy. So we're basically shooting ourselves in the kneecap. That's what Washington is doing because, they're ignoramuses when it comes to economics.
Yeah.
And because there are so many interest groups, including the military-industrial complex, that needs a war every couple of years just to keep the budget at, well, it's $850 billion, and they're going to push it to $900 billion this year, which is crazy. It's as big as the next 12 countries, in the world combined. But, they're an interest group that is pushing the deficits, that's pushing the monetization of the deficits, because that's how they make a living, starting wars everywhere. Forever wars, as I call it. So, we're running out of runway, so to speak.
Right.
We've all these little fixes that they've had, all these patches and these expedients may work for a while, may prolong the period in which you can get away with all of this, violation of fundamental economic principles. But at some point, it catches up with you. There are so many forces at work that you're in between a rock and a hard place. And that's where, Powell is today. You mentioned earlier on, I thought, and others did, that he would persevere far longer than Wall Street expected. You know, they expected a pivot months and months and months ago, and it didn't happen. But there is a reason that is, it's not because he's some profound Austrian economist or has a real comprehension of the magnitude of the problem. He was a lawyer. I mean, Jay Powell was a lawyer who got into the LBO business and, made a lot of friends in Washington, got put on the Fed, and then became chairman. And he's therefore a late recruit, a late in life recruit, trainee to Keynesian economics.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, he takes literally this 2.0% inflation target.
Yeah.
Okay, if you understood economics,
you wouldn't do that.
How arbitrary, how silly, how stupid, the whole thing is. But he actually is what I call a paint by the numbers Keynesian.
Yeah.
And he naively thinks that is his job, to get the measured CPI back, or really PCE deflator, back to 2%. And that he's just going to have to persevere until we get there. Now, he's not going to get there. The breaking furniture is coming in fast and furious. And he's already proven that he's not necessarily going to pivot on the rate policy in terms of the words that are being spoken about where it's going. But when you do things like bail out these two banks on the silly theory that they were too big to fail, these tiny little banks were too big. That's what they used. They used a too big to fail exemption statute you're basically backing and filling. He's going to be pausing too often. And that will just undermine and prolong the agony of the inflation battle that he's trying to carry on. So it's the mm-hmm. worst of both worlds. He's yeah. not going to pivot. He's not going to start cutting rates anytime soon, but he's likely to give enough wrong signals, enough pauses, and enough encouragement to Wall Street that he's about ready to stop, that you're not going to get inflation under control. Here, yeah. here's the point about inflation. I think people know this. No one has ever brought high inflation, and this is 40-year high inflation, 6, 7%, even by the BLS way of measuring, which, you know, undercounts inflation, really. But you're not going to get 6 or 7% inflation down to 2%, or really should be below that, if you have negative real interest rates. Mm-hmm. Well, where are real interest rates today? They just raised funds rate to 4.9%. Mm-hmm. The running inflation rate is 6.5, no matter how you slice it. So the rate is negative 2. Now, I think people should maybe know what Volcker faced back in 79, 80, 81. When he took office in August 79, the real funds rate, federal funds rate, was negative 1.5%, mm-hmm. exactly where it is today. But he realized that until we get that rate significantly and sustainably positive, that is, that rate, the funds rate is well above inflation, we're never going to bring the inflationary cycle, the dynamic, the speculation, all of the forces behind it to heal.
So and do you so, think do you think Powell doesn't see it that way?
Well, I think he's probably underestimated. I don't know that he has looked at the numbers, which he should, and that yeah. is he would be startled. Because this is what I was going to say, by the mid-1981, after Volcker started the campaign, the real funds rate mm-hmm. was over 8%. Now, if you were to get a real funds rate today, even if you think inflation is only 5%, by the way, the Fed measure on the core PCE deflator, that's a 13% implied 13% funds rate.
Incredible.
That would cause an economic collapse of monumental proportions.
Would that make us put us into a depression greater than the 1930s potentially? I mean, I can't imagine.
Well, it would be pretty bad. I think it would be somewhat different. The recession of the 30s, the worst part of it happened out in the countryside because agriculture got way over-invested as a result of, you know, sending food to the world during World War I and, you know, exports being subsidized effectively mm-hmm. in the 20s. So it was pretty much in the industrial centers like Detroit, Pittsburgh, Youngstown, Gary, Indiana, and so forth, and out in the country. That's where the banking crisis developed because all those banks were insolvent when the game, you know, when the music stopped. But today, the crisis will be in Silicon Valley and Wall Street. That yep. is in the financial system and in the derivative of the financial system. Right. So I think the billionaires and the millionaires and the VCs and the founders and all the rest of these, 30, 20 somethings are going to take the biggest part of the rap. Mm. And that says it should be. But it won't be a pleasant time for anybody. Throughout the U.S. economy.
Well, that's for sure, David. Well, just sort of in summing up here then, the overvaluations are in the paper markets, the financial markets, as you say, and in Silicon Valley. It would seem as though we have to get back to making stuff again. I mean, I don't know that Americans have the gumption to do it. Everybody wants to work less and make more money, and nobody wants to do hard things. I mean, I was just talking to some kid recently who he wants to go into marketing, but he doesn't have the kind of, stellar educational background, the kind of thing you need. But he went to Baruch College and he's a good accountant and he can do that. But, you know, accounting is grunt work. It's hard work. And a lot of people, nobody wants to work hard in America anymore. It seems we want to all have our cake and eat it too. So I don't know where we go, but we're going to have to, it seems to me, somehow get back to making things again. Just to survive. I mean, we've depended on China to such a great extent. even our pharmaceuticals and things, we're really kind of screwed, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I think we have to get back to making things and also working. Okay.
Right.
I mean, you know, the bad thing about the whole pandemic period and then the $6 trillion worth of COVID relief measures is that they were just showering free money on almost anybody who raised their hands. I noted the other day that even in that payroll protection plan, so-called, which was allegedly business, small business oriented, over 11 so-called small businesses, 11 million small businesses got the money. Overall, it was $840 billion and $800 billion of it was forgiven. So you basically showered damn near $1 trillion on the business system. And these were a lot of young people that, you know, thought they had a business started up in their mom and dad's basement. And they were getting the free money from Uncle Sam, to say nothing of all the, you know, $2,000 per capita freebie or, you know, bailout checks that were sent. And as a result of that, the economy really, I think, got poisoned with the idea that work and spending don't have a relationship to each other, okay? And that is a pretty, that's a pretty danger. So it's a culture problem. And that's probably why, you know, the great historic Austrian economists were so wise. They said you have to purge the bad developments out of the economy. That's why you have a recession every now and then. And they were basically talking about investment excesses or credit excesses. But now we've got even a culture excess. We've got a attitude that needs to be, you know, severely punished, you know, by unfolding events before people realize that if you want all the nice things in life, you got to put your nose to the grindstone and get back to work. Nobody's going to send you, because there is no free lunch. Nobody's going to send you these freebies indefinitely. And that's the corner we're in right now.
Yeah, we're going to have to get back to work. One more thing I'd like to just have you comment on, David, and that has to do with when most people put their money in the bank, they think it's safe. They think they have got that $250,000 FDIC guarantee. But actually, well, maybe we do now. Janet Yellen might just give us, you know, shower us all with, but that what it becomes worthless money. But the point is that legally and technically, you are a lender to the bank. You are a lender, right? And so people don't really realize that that's not, there's no real guarantee. There's not supposed to be any guarantee there. And banks are supposed to be responsible and be concerned about losing money for its shareholders. Doesn't care now. Janet Yellen's going to bail everybody out, she says. I don't know if she will or not. But just maybe given that fact, people should really be cognizant that, you know, maybe they want to get some assets, some values out, something of value outside of the system, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Now, there is a I do think the deposit insurance is money good at the end of the day. Even if they have to print the dollars, they will pay off the deposit. So people can, you know, if you're fortunate enough to have $1 million worth of bank deposits, you can divide it up into four banks. It'll all be insured. Yes, sure, it'll be okay. But, you know, there is every reason to have a hedge against the policy chaos that we're now in the midst of. And, you know, precious metals, gold is, as J.P. Morgan said long, long ago, gold is money, everything else is credit, okay?
Exactly, exactly.
So there is always room in any portfolio, because at some point, maybe even the deposit insurance can't be paid. There's always room for gold in a portfolio as a hedge, as an insurance, as an anchor to real economics as the world, you know, tumbles into the mess that lies ahead.
All right. Well, David, we'll have to leave it go at that. I thank you so much for your for sharing your time so generously with us. It's always a pleasure having you. And again, it's people want to sign up for David's letter and keep up with what's going on. You know, David does do the hard work. He did the hard work for Ronald Reagan. He was known as a person who was really in the numbers, in the weeds, as it were, and I think was highly regarded in those days as someone who was really on top of the budget. I don't hear anybody giving any OMB people that kind of credit these days, David. I don't think anybody works as hard as you did. I don't think anybody works as hard as you did these days, unfortunately. But I want to thank you so much. It's really an honor to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we'll talk again.
Thank you, David. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, Frank Holmes of US Global will be with us, and Chen Lin will join me as well. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.